I want to read a passage from the old discourses of the Buddha. And this is actually not a conversation with the Buddha, but a conversation between two of Buddha's senior students. One named Venerable Anuruddha, and the other Venerable Sariputta. And once Anuruddha went to see Sariputta, and they said hello to each other and such things. And then Anuruddha said to Venerable Sariputta, this time was a fully enlightened disciple of the Buddha, was teaching himself. And Anuruddha was not enlightened. He was still practicing, an unenlightened person to some degree. But he was a very developed practitioner. He'd been much time practicing. He had developed his meditation to a great extent. And he'd fairly mature in his spiritual life. And Anuruddha came to Sariputta to ask him a question for help. And Anuruddha made this statement. By means of my purified vision, I see the thousandfold cosmos. So that's kind of things I mention that often in ancient discourses. We don't know quite what it means, but we can take it to mean that he has a very high level of meditation development, strong concentration, where he has this attainment where somehow in his mind's eye he can see the cosmos, see the universe in some big way. I don't know what it means, but it's meant to be kind of some great attainment. My persistence is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unaroused. My mind is concentrated into singleness, into oneness. And yet, my mind is not released from the effluence, from the toxins, because I still cling. So he's not liberated. His mind is still troubled. Mind is still agitated because he still clings, has this kind of clinging, grasping in his mind. So it's kind of a great question. Here's someone who actually has a high degree of attainment, meditative attainment, has strong mindfulness, strong concentration, and he recognizes that he still somehow is not liberated. And one of the things that happens when people develop their practice stronger and stronger, oddly enough, people become in some ways more sensitive to the ways in which the mind is entrapped, captured, suffering, grasping, clinging. And the analogy would be like if you have a white handkerchief that's all completely dirty, it might be so dirty that you put one more stain on it, you don't even see it, you don't even notice. But if you bleach and wash that handkerchief, and then it's completely white, then a single stain would really stand out a lot. And so, I think the Christian saying, it goes something like, maybe some of you will help me get it right, something about, for a saint, something which is inconsequential for an ordinary person, for a saint is like having a splinter in the eye. Someone notice this saying? No one? Did I just make it up? And so the idea being that the more developed spiritually someone is, the greater sensitivity there is to the painful ways in which the mind and the heart operate. And so you might think, well, gee, then maybe I don't want to become a spiritually mature person. A blissful ignorance would be nice. I thought Buddhist meditation was about becoming stress-free and being calm. And you're telling me if I get stress-free and calm, I become more sensitive to these, uncomfortable aspects of how my mind works? It works that way, yes. But it's a good thing that it works that way, because that's what allows you to purify, allows you to liberate, to free yourself. as we say, you know, it's better to know if you're suffering, if you're grasping, if you're agitated. It's better to know you are suffering or agitated or grasping than to continue living a life not knowing it, if you are. And many, many people live their lives without really understanding to the dimensions and degree to which, or ways in which their mind and heart is in pain, is suffering, is grasping, is resisting, is defensive, lives in fear, is driven by ambition and greed, or aversion and hate, and judgments and criticism, self-judgments and other judgments and all these things. And so if those things are going on, a step to healing, a step to the liberation, to freedom from all that, is to be really see that really clearly. And so the more developed we become, the more sensitive we become to that. And so here is this Aniruddha, who is very sensitive to this and has done great practice, but still he's not liberated. He comes to ask for help. So as I read this passage, does any of you, maybe I'll read it again, but maybe you can diagnose this problem here. So listen carefully. By means of the divine eye, purified, I see the thousandfold cosmos. My persistence is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unaroused. My mind is concentrated into oneness. And yet my mind is not released from the effluence through the lack of clinging. What's his problem? Yeah, please.
Maybe he's clinging to the thought of enlightenment. Could
be. Good. So maybe that's the last clinging that's standing in the way of enlightenment itself. Enlightenment is freedom from clinging, and if you cling to enlightenment, that's a barrier. Yes.
I don't remember that it seemed like, well, if that's the case, then he shouldn't be clinging. One of the items that you said, he may not really have accurately diagnosed his own state, so to speak.
Could be. So many meditators misdiagnose, misevaluate their meditation states or their spiritual state. Sometimes people overestimate how wonderful they are. And sometimes people underestimate how wonderful they are. You know, in terms of, am I ever concentrated? Boy, am I ever mindful? Oh, I'm not so mindful. And one of the things I've noticed as a teacher is this often happens. And sometimes you have people who, for whom the meditation practice is going really well. There's a lot of concentration, a lot of joy, a lot of calm, a lot of peace. And they'll come and tell me, oh, there's a lot of concentration, a lot of joy, a lot of calm, a lot of peace. It's really good. I'm practicing really well. Oh, good. And then someone else will come to me and say, oh, there's no concentration, there's no peace. It's so hard for me. I'm so agitated, or I'm so much turmoil in my life, or I'm so much physical pain, difficulty, and my mind just can't settle down, and I keep, you know, trying, but my practice is really bad. Sometimes I hear people come and talk to me that way, and I kind of listen to them or look at them more carefully, and sometimes I'll see, well, the person who is calm and concentrated, they're taking too much credit for that. Sometimes, you know, it's just they had a good nap, they had a good, just ate just the right amount of food, the temperature was good, and maybe they went for a nice walk, and and they just kind of like, causes and conditions came together for some strange reason, that their mind was settled for that hour. And it wasn't because of years of practice. It was just kind of like luck. You know, something. You know, it happens that way sometimes. And the other person who's struggling, and he says, oh, my practice is so poor, I look at that person and say, wow, that person is practicing really well. They're really trying, they're putting themselves into it, and even though they think they're not very mindful, there's a lot of attention, a lot of mindfulness, a lot of effort to be present. And they're really going all out to try to do their best in this practice. And it's really hard for them. They're struggling. It's really hard. That's true. But their practice, but again, it's bad luck. Causes and conditions have come together. I don't know why, the mind is operating this way. But given what their mind is given, they're practicing really well. It doesn't look good, it doesn't feel good, but they're practicing really well. And sometimes I have tremendous admiration for people who practice patiently patiently and even courageously when their life is going through great difficulty. They don't give up. They hang in there. And it's rather embarrassing for me to tell you this as a teacher, but maybe it's useful to as an encouragement. Once or twice in the many years I've taught, I have encountered a student who struggled for years in their meditation practice. And not so much in daily meditation practice. That went pretty well. It was very nice for the first people. But when they went on meditation retreats, it was really hard for them. And this thought went through my head and said, Gil, maybe you should advise this person to give up meditation. Maybe it's not working for them. Maybe they should do something else that works better. But I've held my tongue because it's a big thing to say to someone who's devoted a lot of years to practice and really, really devoted, and has a lot of faith and confidence in what they're doing. And be careful. Who am I to know what the karma is of this person and what they're doing? So I've been hesitant sometimes. And then to find out, maybe a year later, a few years later, to see the person again, and to see that the fruit of all that hard work, that somehow they've been transformed and changed in a way that is awesome. They had to deal with a huge challenge in their inner life, in their personal life, and they hung in there with great courage, working with the difficulty, working with the discomfort, working with the emotional pain. And they saw to the other side. And I said, and then I was embarrassed. I'm sure glad I didn't say anything to them. I'm the teacher. I'm the one who's supposed to have confidence in the practice and, cheer people on and keep them going. And I was having doubts, So that's why it's embarrassing. But I've seen that, people who have really, so people over-evaluate their practice too easily and people under-evaluate their practice too easily. And sometimes that's the value of having a teacher who can kind of help you out and make a correction for that. But now you'll never come to me. Now that I've told you. Yes?
Maybe he's afraid that he will lose this mindfulness and that is bothering him.
Ah, so he's afraid he's going to lose his mindfulness. His mindfulness is strong and he's afraid he's going to lose his mindfulness and that's bothering him. Keeps him agitated. Okay, very good. Right behind you.
Perhaps he had a mystical experience and understood that that is also transient.
Maybe he had a mystical experience and he understood that's also transient and impermanent. And so there's some feeling that, why is that a problem? So he's
it may not have been a problem. It may have been an observation that he had this feeling of oneness. Mm-hmm. But moment later, he realized that that feeling, that oneness that he was feeling is temporary.
So maybe he was at some degree of enlightenment, but he didn't see it because it passed also?
Say that again?
He had some experience of enlightenment.
Yes.
But he didn't see it as that because it passed as well.
Right.
Okay. Matt?
Maybe he thinks he needs to do something or go somewhere when actually what he really needs to do is surrender.
Maybe he thinks he needs to attain something and get something, but maybe he just needs to let go. So that's true for many meditators, that sometimes they get caught up in being goal-oriented. And the very kind of pursuit and striving pursuit for a goal, get something, stands in their way of getting somewhere. It's a paradox.
Maybe he realizes he hasn't really been tested yet. He's
he hangs out with a very kind crowd. The alms bowl gets filled every day. Gets to listen to the Buddha every day. And you know, what if it all broke up? Or what if the Buddha, for some reason, kicked him out? Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't. He knows he wouldn't like that.
Ah, so yeah, that's good. So it happens sometimes that people can think that they have some high degree of spiritual maturation when all the cosmic conditions around them help them stay calm or peaceful, and it's, you know, the kind of the stereotypic example of this is of a person who goes, like a monk goes into the forests of Thailand where it's very peaceful and serene perhaps, and spends, you know, years and years and years on retreat and attains great peace and serenity, and the serenity just seems to last and last, and the rainy season comes and the peace lasts, and the hot season comes and the peace lasts, and they, wow, you know, I'm hot stuff. You know, I'll never get agitated again. The peace is set in. I've got it. I've arrived. And then they go to. Then they, for some reason, they have to go to Bangkok. And they're completely frazzled. And they get irritated and angry, and you know, they don't even know how to cope. And you know, and they go, I got to get back to the forest. But this, I can't handle this. And then they realize that city people like you might be actually be more developed, you know, because you don't get frazzled so easily when you get in Highway 101. So yeah, okay. Right next to you, Andrea.
Possibly the way that it's worded, that it, what came to my mind is that there is too much of an agent behind the words. So I am my concentration, my view of being mm-hmm. able to, and in the end, I think that's what's holding him back. Uh-huh.
So there's too much self involved, too much self identity. You know, thinking I'm in charge, I'm the one who's doing. I've attained concentration, I've attained mindfulness, I've seen the great cosmos. You know, I've done all these things, and so perhaps that sense of I is standing in the way. So good, and so that's probably enough because. Sariputra then responds. It tells Anuruddha what his problem is. And the first thing he says is what Andrea said, that there's too much self there. But he says more than that. He says, this is what Sariputra says in response. My friend, so nice when you start that way. He's going to admonish his friend, right? And he says, he starts with my friend. That's very nice. May everyone be admonished that way. When the thought occurs to you, by means of the divine eye, purified, I see the thousandfold cosmos, that is related to your conceit. So conceit can be very, very subtle. But it's kind of like, oh, I've done something. I've attained something. It seems innocent enough to do that. But it can be very gross, the conceit, but it can be a very simple little kind of turn in the mind where, oh, I'm the one. And in a sense, you are the one, but who, you know, has attainment, who is concentrated or whatever. But even the idea that I'm the one who's done it is extra. It's not needed. And it gets in the way. It kind of muddies the water. You don't need to, you know, you know, say that you're, you know, say that you're a good walker. Some of you guys are good walkers, right? You've figured it out for a number of years now how to walk. And you know, so you know, you're going down the streets and you walk, and then you say, well, you know, I'm a good walker. I'm a good walker. You know, what's that about? Why do you need to kind of walk? You know, congratulate yourself on being a good walker. It's a it's amazing accomplishment. You know, to walk on two legs, and it's an evolutionary kind of, you know, miracle. It's not an easy thing for living beings to have discovered how to walk on two legs. You know, it's like a pinnacle. It's one of the pinnacles of evolution. You see, oh, look at me, I'm a good walker. So it's, you know, it's a little extra going on there. You don't need to. So the same thing with meditation practice. And in fact, as meditation practice gets deeper or more concentrated for people, One of the very important qualities that needs to be developed is the quality of ordinariness, where the strong, sometimes very unusual, kind of heightened or rarefied states of meditation that can occur, that they no longer seem special. They're special, you know, from one perspective, but to do them enough, to repeat and re-experience them enough over and over again, that their specialness falls away. And it starts feeling ordinary, almost routine. And the value of that is, as it gets more ordinary and routine, then the sense of self and the sense of, you know, specialness, and this is wonderful, and self-congratulation, all kind of subtle, gross and subtle things that go on in relationship to it will stop. And it becomes ordinary. Go. And what happens then when it's ordinary is the mind can relax more, and then it's easier to let go further. But it's harder to let go in a deep way when you're kind of thinking, oh, this is special, this is neat. And it's not unusual for some people who meditate to experience some unusual state of calm or joy or peace, and then get excited. Wow. And then they pop out of that. You know, it's kind of like they kind of destroy it because you get so excited. Oh, look. Oh, wow. I can't wait to tell someone. And then, oh, what happened to it? So conceit. But then Sariputta goes on. When the thought occurs to you, my persistence is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unperturbed. My mind is concentrated into oneness. That is related to your restlessness. Interesting. Your restlessness. And you think that it's such a pristine state, you know, oneness, concentrated, unperturbed. How could there be restlessness in there? Restlessness can be very, very subtle. Very subtle movement of the mind, looking, searching, wanting something to happen, not quite satisfied with what is happening, and wanting something different, wanting something more. Somehow, kind of, and even the effort to evaluate and judge your experience. Oh, I'm concentrated. I'm in oneness. Even though, you know, it's a reasonable thing to do to see that. It's also in deep meditation when the mind gets very still, it becomes extra. Not needed. It's like, you know, saying, you know, oh, look what a good walker I am. Not needed. So he calls it restlessness here. And then when the thought occurs to you, and yet my mind is not released from the effluence, from the toxins, the poisons, by means of freedom from clinging, that is related to your anxiety. Someone said something like that, didn't they? So it was anxious. And so some people's relationship to spiritual growth, development, freedom, liberation is one of anxiety. They feel that their safety, their salvation is going to come through an experience. They're having some kind of thing happen to them. And so they're anxious about getting it. They're anxious about, you know, not getting it, and worried, oh, if I don't get it, then I won't look good, or if I don't get it, I won't be saved, if I don't get it, then, you know, my life won't have any meaning. Or there's many things people assign to, meaning they as people assign to spiritual attainment, spiritual realization. And here he calls that anxiety. So in order to go further, this man who's already fairly well developed, he has to learn how to let go of his conceit, his sense of self and self-identity, and he has to learn how to let go of his restlessness, which might not feels like so much restlessness, but very subtle movement and agitation of the mind, and has to let go, perhaps surrender, a certain degree of anxiety or fear that's maybe in the background. And all three of these can be very hard to see. I mean, certainly I think all of us can see gross experience of conceit, restlessness, and anxiety. But for someone who's well developed and trained in spiritual practice, and sometimes it can be very hard to see the subtlety of how this works. And the first one in particular, I think, is a big one for many people. The way in which the sense of self, which interferes with the very growth of spiritual development and growth. Yes, Dick.
I've been wondering how much longer the discussion will go before we realize that we have to talk about what happens to meditators when we become a parent.
When we become a parent?
A parent. There's this presence which changes the whole dynamic of our lives,
yes.
Generally speaking, if I'm not exaggerating it too much. That must be figured in.
Yes, right? I agree. And conceit and restlessness and anxiety are factors that come into play when you're a parent as well. And they sometimes can get masked or justified justified or seen as this is the way things have to be. It's supposed to be this way when you're a parent, because you think, oh, I'm supposed to be anxious for my child. It's okay to be conceited in some ways for my child. You know, think my child is really special. I'm special or whatever. And it's supposed to be kind of restless somehow. It's kind of built into it all. And I've seen in myself, and I've seen in other parents, inability or hesitation or kind of having blinders on, where people somehow are blinded by the responsibility of being a parent, to not really turn the attention back on themselves, to really see what they're doing in their own minds, in their own hearts, that's extra, that's not needed. And so that's one of the hopes, I think, of mindfulness practice, is to be able to turn the attention back in all kinds of situations. And so here we're talking about meditation practice, and it's one of the main things we do here is meditation practice. But what you learn about yourself in meditation practice will help you understand yourself outside of meditation practice. So if you can see the forces that keep you from being in deep peace in meditation, it gives you a vantage point to much better kind of to highlight or see more carefully how you lose that peace when you're parenting, for example, and the forces that come into play. And so some parents, for example, the conceit operates that they need to look good. They want to be a good parent. And, they have this idea of what it means to be a good parent. And I've certainly succumbed to that kind of difficulty. Or restless, there's all kinds of restlessness in my being parent, thinking and worrying. And, I went on this retreat last month, and the day before, I was on retreat Monday through Friday. And so I was home on the weekend because my kids are young. And then I volunteered Monday morning. The idea was to go to the retreat Sunday evening after the kids were asleep. But Sunday off, well, I'll stay overnight and bring my oldest son to school in the morning, because he was going to go on a 3-day camping trip with the school. And the first 3 days away from us ever, 9 years old. So big, big step, right? And so I went and drove them there, and the bus that was going to take them to where they're going to go wasn't there yet. So all these kids, 6:30 in the morning, all these kids were there in the school parking lot. So we were hanging out there, and they were going to go up to Ukiah. It was really cold in March. And so I saw them off, and then I went back to my retreat. And for the next half the day of the retreat, I couldn't get concentrated. My mind was restless. And it was kind of, oh no, I didn't pack warm socks. it's raining, and he's going to be cold, and he's going to be wet, and he's never going to get, And so all this anxiety arose, and it was really hard. It was really hard for me to turn back and see deep inside of myself what was going on. But tell me, why are you asking the question?
You answered it very well. Except that I was thinking also of how the child, as he or she is growing up, starts out very conceited and very self-centered. And typically they grow out of that. And it served for me as a model of, compressed in a shorter time period, of course, of how I need to work out conceit of in a different scale, sort of, for an adult to work it out as for a child. But still, it's a very vivid example because we relate very personally to what's happening with the child.
Right.
And we have to try to coach them along to grow out of this as well as watching our own selves.
Yes. So if I understand what you're saying, is that you're saying that you're suggesting that children go through a phase where they develop a strong sense of self and being maybe center of the world and their world, and it's, you call it maybe conceit or something, kind of sense, strong sense of self. And then at some point developmentally, it's possible for the child to relax that as well, and so that softens, and maybe some of the unhealthy forms of it kind of might disappear. And then in that, that's kind of normal, maybe somewhat normal developmental process for children. Can there be similar normal developmental process for adults who didn't do it healthily when they were kids? Didn't, you know, see it through to the end when they were kids? And I think there's some truth to that. And when I was living at the San Francisco Zen Center, I practiced there for many years, it was kind of a residential community. Back then, especially when I was young, I went there when I was about, first time I think it was about 20. And there were a lot of young people practicing back then, still are. And one of the teachers there observed to me, said to me one day, that a lot of people will come to the Zen Center and practice there for a number of years. And after about 3 to 5 years, many people leave. And what's happening for most of these young people when they come through in their early years, they're not really practicing Buddhism. What they're doing is finding themselves. There's a tremendous need to find, they're alienated from their culture, their society, they're kind of counterculture people sometimes back then. And they're kind of trying to find themselves and find themselves in community. They don't have community. And so the whole idea of living in community, in a Buddhist community, and working there, was their attempt to try to find themselves. And once they kind of had some sense of who they were and what they're about, and some healthy kind of relationship to themselves and other people, often it involved uniting or kind of a cleaning up the relationship to their own parents. And sometimes it was cleaning up the relationships to their own religion that they grew up in. And I saw people who would go back and reestablish connection to parents they weren't talking to. I saw people who would actually find, after a few years of Zen practice, would through that practice, through the kind of what was revealed or what they understood through that spiritual life, they began to appreciate the value of the religion they grew up in. And they went back to their Christianity or back to their Judaism. So kind of finding themselves, finding some new way, right? And then the teacher told me, many people leave after they find themselves. But those people who stay after that period of finding themselves at 3 to 5 years, those are the people who finally start practicing Buddhism. Because Buddhism is not about finding yourself, but something further. You have to have some sense of strength, inner strength, in order to be able to really go further. You can't be a completely confused person. Sometimes you have people who are so confused and lost, and they think, oh, this is, you know, I don't fit in anywhere. I don't even know who I am. And this Buddhism is, you know, God sent to me because I can be a nobody. I can be a not self, but I don't have to find myself. I can just kind of be, you know, empty, and then empty and happy, right? And they're just, most of those people do a disservice to themselves and to others, that kind of attitude. But you don't want to take that. So I don't know if you're talking personally about yourself, you want to be careful with that kind of rationalization that, oh, I have to do all this work first about self and establish myself, and eventually I'll get to the real important work of freeing my heart. You may be careful with that kind of rationalization when you get to your age.
I'm still waiting for the instruction book about how to raise my son, and now I have a granddaughter too, and I still don't know.
So when I was sitting this retreat, and this is partly the inspiration to read this passage to you today, when I was sitting this retreat in March, there was one period of the retreat where I was slow to catch on. That's often the case when you when there's some kind of difficulty in meditation practice. You're kind of slow to catch on. But the hindrance was my sense of self that was operating. And it happened in a number of ways that this operated. And sometimes I made too much effort. You know, I'm a meditation teacher. You know, this should be easy for me, right? I should just get in there, get concentrated. You know, so that's conceit, right? You know. So that was there, and that took a couple of days to kind of notice that it was operating in the background. Oh, gee. And I better not tell anybody. They'll be really embarrassed. I should have more conceit, right? and certainly the idea of anxiety. Oh, you know, it's pretty rare for me to be able to go on a whole month of retreat. I better make the best of this. Better try harder. And as soon as I try harder, you know, that's just, you know, makes it worse. So, you know, there was a kind of after about 5 days or so, there was a few days there where. So what often happens on retreat also for people is that retreat is a fantastic place to start separating out to clarify. It's kind of like you're purifying yourself, and as you purify yourself or purify the gold, for example, you start seeing the impurities. And it's hard to see it otherwise. In daily life, it's hard to see what's going on. And so you might have a certain way of practicing, or a certain way of understanding yourself, or a certain way of carrying yourself in the world, which is not really a problem in daily life. And you're always so distracted anyway, it's not really going to be an issue. But as the mind gets simpler and simpler on retreat, some of the hindrances in our life, some of the obstacles, some of the wind drags, some of the things that are holding us down or back, become more and more obvious. And that's part of the beauty of retreat, is to have that purification, that simplification process. So we can see exactly what it is that we're doing, and then work with it and perhaps surrender it, let go of it. And I think it's a beautiful process, because it's a process that step by step we take responsibility. We understand ourselves more and more deeply, and we start taking responsibility for ourselves in some deep way. Sometimes there are attempts to kind of or desire to have spiritual bypasses, and you know, and say somehow, you know, do it quickly, you know, LSD, or sometimes you have certain gurus that will zap you, just do the work for you. You have this great charisma, and they just do something, and you leave. And LSD and charismatic gurus, are great. They have their place. But sometimes people will hang out with those things as a way of avoiding responsibility and avoiding the more grounding work, the really understanding themselves in a deep way. And so sometimes this practice that we do here is a slow practice. But I think in being slow, step by step, it's a practice where we're really beginning to understand ourselves step by step, deeper and deeper ways, and do that purification or clarification work. And take responsibility for how we manifest ourselves and what we do and for our clinging. And it's a great thing. And I've been so inspired by so many people, many of you, who have practiced so well and who have matured so wonderfully through this practice. I think if the confidence is there, the practice will take you wherever you want, wherever you need to go. Thank you for this evening, and thank you for your answers.